Today, we talk about Gaza's blockade generation. And The Guardian's Raphael Baer warns Remainers that an extension to Brexit is not victory.
So to get to Gaza from Jerusalem, it's not a very long drive. It's less than an hour and a half. And you get to this place called Erez, which is the last point in Israel before you cross over. Imagine going to an airport in the middle of the night, you know, when it was closed between midnight and 3 a.m. That there's almost nobody in there. And there are loads and loads of counters where it was intended that passports would be stamped, people would go through. But only two are open, one for foreigners and one for Palestinians.
Since 2007, the people of Gaza have lived under a blockade. It's one implemented on land, air and sea, crippling the country's economy and imprisoning its 2 million citizens. For young people growing up in Gaza, it's all they've ever known.
I always find it incredibly weird to go in there because for me, as a journalist, it's very, very easy to cross over and to go back. You know, I could go into Gaza in the morning and leave in the afternoon. And there are people there my age who have never left.
For a year, Palestinians have protested at the Gaza-Israel border against the blockade. Israel's lethal response to the outpouring has caused tensions to rise. Last week, militants fired two rockets towards Tel Aviv in the first such attack in 5 years. Meanwhile, Hamas supported the activists at the border, but now face their own demonstrations in the cities against dire living conditions in Gaza, with footage last week of police beating demonstrators. For Gaza's young people, there's disillusionment, with many starting to question the worth of weekly protests at the frontier. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what does the future hold for Gaza's blockade generation? What's the current situation in Gaza at the moment?
So the current situation in Gaza is that it's a small piece of land with a few cities in it, 2 million people, almost completely cut off from the outside world.
Oliver Holmes is The Guardian's Jerusalem correspondent.
Hamas, which is an Islamist militant group and political organisation, is in control of this small strip of land bordering Israel and Egypt. And both countries have imposed a blockade on Gaza, which limits people and also goods coming in and out of the area. So the people in Gaza describe the area as the world's largest open-air prison.
And can you just explain why Israel have put the blockade in place and also why Egypt are also preventing people coming in and out?
Israel has fought three wars with Hamas. And Hamas will fire rockets into Israel.
The single largest Qassam rocket attack, the target, an Israeli army training base about a kilometre north of the Gaza border. More than 60 soldiers were injured, at least four seriously.
So Israel will say that they need to enforce this blockade to prevent people getting into Israel and conducting attacks. And Egypt has a very similar reasoning. The current military government in Egypt, they are very much against the Muslim Brotherhood, which is allied with Hamas. And so they are also do not want to allow people into their own territory.
And are you able to report freely from Gaza?
Yeah, absolutely. To an extent, where it becomes difficult to report in Gaza is that people are very aware that open criticism of Hamas is not tolerated. Of course, you want to get the truth, but at the same time, you want to make sure that people don't say things that are going to get themselves into trouble.
And you said that some of the residents describe Gaza as the world's largest open-air prison. When you're walking through, when you walk into the country, do you see signs of that?
Absolutely. You know, for me to wake up in Jerusalem and then to drive an hour and a half down pristine motorways, you know, in a country with a booming economy, and then to just 30 minutes later be in a place where there are donkey carts on the roads, you know, the roads are completely ruined, the water is dangerous to drink, there's power cuts. It just feels like a very artificial situation.
When a lot of people think about Gaza, one of the kind of images that comes to mind is of people protesting along the border fences. And those protests have increased in intensity since May 2018. Why did they begin?
Most people in Gaza are refugees from around the time of Israel's creation in 1948. And they fled their homes and moved into Gaza. So the idea of the protests are that they want to return to their sort of ancestral houses.
The first day of a planned six-week protest has turned deadly in the West Bank and Gaza. Israeli forces responded with force against rock-throwing Palestinian protesters. At least seven Palestinians have been killed. Hundreds more have been wounded. Palestinian leadership, including Hamas, has called for mass demonstrations leading up to the 70th anniversary of the war that led to the founding of the State of Israel in 1948.
So that's how they started on March 30th last year, but grew bigger and bigger because it became supported by political factions inside Gaza, including the rulers Hamas.
In Jerusalem, a moment of triumph as U.S. and Israeli officials celebrate the opening of the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. At the same time in Gaza, the violent reaction that move is fueling. Palestinian officials say Israel's military has killed at least 43 people and wounded 1,600.
And why do people keep going?
So when you speak to people, there's a sense of desperation. They're really struggling with poverty. They have huge amounts of frustration. They don't know what to do. And so they go there and they protest. When you go to one of these protests, you'll be maybe 300 meters from the fence. And behind it, there are Israeli soldiers. And quite far back, it's kind of a festival atmosphere, where there's lots of families and there are people buying food and eating food, and there are loudspeakers chanting Palestinian songs. And then as you get closer, there are younger people throwing rocks. There are people burning tires, big, large plumes of smoke, people sort of rushing towards the fence. Israeli soldiers are firing tear gas and sometimes live ammunition at people along the frontier.
And do any of the things that are being thrown over from the Gaza side get anywhere close to the soldiers?
There have been people who have thrown Molotov cocktails, so bottles with burning petrol in them. There have been instances of grenades being thrown. But I haven't seen an instance in which something has reached the Israeli soldiers. But I should mention that one Israeli soldier has been killed.
And you've talked about Israeli forces firing on people. I mean, just the other week there was another death, a teenager shot dead by troops. How many people have died from these protests?
So around 180 people have been killed. What hospitals and aid groups are reporting is that the number of people who have been shot in the lower limbs is much, much higher. That's up to around 6,000 people. So the real toll that you see in Gaza is people walking around with limb amputations, people with metal rods in their legs. And this is something that you see all over the strip.
So you're usually based in Jerusalem. Why did you decide to go to Gaza?
Well, these protests are definitely getting smaller. And I went down to Gaza recently to go and meet young people who are in their 20s, who have lived their adult lives under blockade and not been able to leave, to ask them why they're protesting. And if they're not protesting, why have they stopped? And to see if support for this whole movement, which has not really produced any tangible results, has started to wane. So I met this one man called Khaled Al-Nayrab, who is a 22-year-old rapper, and he has never left, and very few of his friends have never left. His entire life he's spent in the Gaza Strip.
And he's a rapper.
He rapped for me a song about unemployment, a song about just the frustrations of living in Gaza. Often when you read about Gaza, you'll read about the sort of the most dire poverty-stricken situations. And I was interested in Khaled because he wasn't living, you know, down at that line. I guess you could call him middle class if such a thing exists in Gaza.
And you said he was rapping about unemployment. Youth unemployment rates are incredibly high in Gaza.
I think youth unemployment in Gaza is around 70 or 80%. I asked him at one point, you know, are you worried after you finish your degree at university if you're going to find a job? And he said, I'm not worried. I'm certain I'm not going to find a job.
So what are his hopes for his future in Gaza?
Well, he doesn't really have any. He knows that he is unlikely to be able to leave in the near future. So he is just going to keep on living his life. And the way he described that to me was a kind of crushing routine.
So has he been protesting at the border?
So Khaled, interestingly, is against the protests. He has been to them. He actually made a music video at the protests. Broadly supportive of them, but he is of the opinion, which I'm increasingly hearing in Gaza, is that this movement is reckless and misguided.
Why did he say that?
You know, he is looking back at the past year of protests and he is seeing the number of people who have been shot. He just doesn't see any result from these protests, and he feels like people are putting their lives in danger without purpose.
What does he think he could do to change that?
On a very personal level, he hopes he can leave. He has friends who have smuggled themselves out in underground tunnels into Egypt and then moved from Egypt to Europe on boats.
Were you surprised by his attitude towards the protests?
I wasn't surprised because I've started to hear that a lot more. You have seen the numbers at these protests dwindle. The whole movement has been such a catastrophe. From day one, it was bloody. What result did people want from this?
And you also met a former taxi driver, Mohamed Wadia.
He was outside of a health centre. He was limping along. He had metal rods in his legs from where he had been shot. He said that he had worked as a taxi driver and people were asking him for lifts to the frontier to go to the protests. So he went along with them. And he said on one day, in his own words, he says he got caught up in the emotion of it all and started throwing stones himself and started trying to get close to the fence. And he eventually reached it. And it was at that point that he was shot in the leg. He had to sell his car, so he had lost his job. And he's become completely disillusioned with the protests. He described it to me as a lie.
Why? Because he had felt that by going there, that he could make a change and that, in fact, all it did was take away his livelihood.
Yeah. And he said that the week after he was shot, he was a hero. And then everyone forgot about him. And now he's got a damaged leg, no job, and just hanging out outside health clinics.
And so on this trip, you discovered a kind of fading hope with the protests on the Gaza side of the fence. What's going on the Israel side of the fence? Are there still people protesting for peace?
I went to a protest here. It was a protest in Jerusalem of Israeli left-wing activists who were protesting, you know, for Palestinians not to be evicted from their homes. And it was a very, very small protest. And even the people there acknowledged that their numbers had dwindled as well.
Why is that?
Well, they say it's a number of reasons. One is that this is a country where, you know, they have had the most right-wing government in its history and power for a long time. And there's a constricting space for pro-peace activists or anti-occupation activists here. And it's also just a question of the situation has been going on in its current form for so long that these groups haven't had much success. You know, there hasn't been a successful Israeli-Palestinian peace process, really, for years and years and years. And so I think there's a sense of fatigue and also a sense that the situation can't be changed.
Last month, the former Israeli Foreign Minister Zippy Livni announced she was quitting Israeli politics and won't stand in upcoming elections.
Today, I ask forgiveness from all those who wrote to me, sent me text messages, phoned me, hugged me on the street, and told me to remain strong. I am still strong. I still believe our way is right and good for Israel. But this is the right decision for now.
She said it was because of the changing attitude to peace. Can you explain that?
Yeah, she's a politician who actually started her career in the same party as Netanyahu, but has since become a big advocate of negotiations. But she was saying that that peace has become a dirty word, and that it's not a big issue in this election, and so she was leaving. Having said that, I met with one Israeli politician. His name is Yossi Beilin.
I don't know how to tweet.
Look at Bibi.
Yeah, Bibi and Trump.
He is now no longer in politics, but he was very active in the 90s. And he says that although you don't see a big peace movement in Israel, don't be dissuaded that it's not there. It's just that people need a trigger.
How important is the issue of peace and negotiations in Israeli politics today?
It's very hard. It is the most important thing. Sometimes it is the elephant in the room.
Maybe a renewed negotiations or something to happen, and then you'll see people come out and push for this.
This is the main issue. Settlements, non-settlements, Jerusalem, united, not united.
And what about the Palestinian authorities? Are they hopeful for a resolution?
Well, the Palestinian Authority, which is the group that governs parts of the West Bank, was supposed to only last for a few years after a deal made in the 90s, and has stayed on. And its leader, Mahmoud Abbas, is quite old now and ailing, and people don't really expect him to want to push through to make a deal. People say that he's very confident in and comfortable in his position at the moment, in which he rules small parts of the West Bank, rather than taking a risk on trying to make a deal.
Oliver, are people giving up on the idea of a two-state solution?
I think they are. A lot of people see that as an outdated and impossible idea. If you just look at the situation here, you have large numbers of Israeli settlers living in the West Bank in huge neighbourhoods, which don't seem to be going away. And you have Palestinian Authority, which doesn't seem to be making any efforts to push for peace. And you have an election coming up in Israel where peace and negotiations are not high in public discourse. The other issue that people have with a two-state solution is that the Palestinians are divided between Gaza and the West Bank. And under a two-state solution, it was envisioned that those two areas would become one state together. They're not only they're geographically separated, but you have the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and Hamas governing Gaza, and they're at odds with each other. So in Gaza, two-state solution seems like a very, very distant or impossible prospect as well.
And so it feels as though nothing's changing, and yet these protests go on in Gaza. Do you think there are things that the protests have achieved?
I'm not sure if the protests have achieved much, but it's extremely hard to tell. The aim of the protests was, even a small aim, was to lift the blockade somewhat. And that hasn't really happened. You're not seeing more goods being allowed into Gaza, and you're not seeing more people being allowed out of Gaza.
Do you think that more and more people, like those you met who've lived in Gaza all their lives, will start to feel the way that Khaled felt? And do you think the protests will fade?
I think the protests have been fading the past few weeks and months. And it's also a question of whether Hamas in Gaza decide to continue with this strategy and decide they want to really boost it again 1 year later. And that could be very dangerous.
Don't the protests keep the world's eyes on Gaza? Is there a risk that if the protests stop, then people stop thinking about what's going on?
Yeah, but I think if you were to ask someone in Gaza, they would say, well, the world's eyes have been in Gaza, and why? How is our situation different to a year ago? What use is it having the world's eyes on Gaza? How does that help people there?
Oliver, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do read Oliver Holmes' reporting and watch his film on Gaza at our website, theguardian.com. Coming up, is it good news for Remainers that Brexit could be about to be delayed?
Hi, I'm Will Dean, editor of The Guardian Weekly. Since you're a Today in Focus listener, there's a good chance you'll love The Guardian Weekly. It's The Guardian's essential weekly news magazine, featuring a carefully curated selection of Guardian and Observer journalism to give you a global perspective on the issues that matter. You'll find leading opinion writing, analysis, long reads, and cultural coverage from around the world, with free worldwide delivery. So, if you think globally, now's the perfect time to start reading weekly. Visit gu.com/TIFGW.
Welcome back. Now, The Guardian columnist Raphael Baer argues that Remainers shouldn't be cheering too much about a possible extension to Brexit. What they need to do, he says, is urgently start making a positive argument about staying in the EU.
If Britain wants to preserve a healthy relationship with the European Union, it's not enough that Brexit fails. Enough people have to want Brexit to fail. The thing is, at the moment, the whole process of leaving the EU is looking like a bit of a disaster. Theresa May is going to end up pleading for an extension to the Article 50 negotiating period at an EU summit tomorrow, and there's no particular incentive for the EU27 to deny her that chance. They don't want to actually push the UK off the edge of a cliff. So that's kind of like a win for the Remain cause, right? I mean, ultimately, it feels as if Britain was going to leave the EU on the 29th of March, and now it's not. But the thing is, it doesn't feel to me like that's such a great victory for Remainers. Once Britain's in an Article 50 extension, then all sorts of things become possible. And obviously a lot of people, the People's Vote campaign for a start, are going to want to talk about a referendum. But a referendum is an outcome. It's not actually a destination. And there are an awful lot of people who seem to think that just by calling for a referendum, that makes the case for keeping Britain in the European Union. But it really doesn't. In fact, I think there are quite a lot of people who have their doubts about Brexit, can recognise that the whole thing hasn't really gone according to plan, maybe voted Leave in 2016 but can see that the whole enterprise has gone a bit sour. But frankly, the last thing they want is another vote, another referendum. What those people need is something a lot more positive to hold on to, something to think they might get out of Britain staying in the European Union other than endless votes, endless arguments and yet more bickering and campaigning. My sense is that a lot of the people who've been supporting a people's vote, especially in Parliament, have got the argument the wrong way around. They're trying to make the case for having a referendum and then hoping that when they win that, then you start making the case for staying in the European Union. But what you need, and a need I think quite urgently if you're a Remainer, is to actually build the argument for staying in the European Union on its own terms. There's been this conventional wisdom for quite a long time that British electorates just don't like pro-European arguments. And I think the Remain campaign in 2016 really felt that. They thought if you ran around saying that the European Union is a great thing and that Britain should stay in the EU because we love Europe, well, then you'd lose by even more than 52-48. But ultimately, the situation we're in now is that almost no one is making the case for European Union membership on its own terms. We just keep hearing an argument about the referendum itself. At some point, if you're going to persuade people, you're going to need to build up the case that says Britain's interests are served by staying in the European Union. All the things that Britain wants to achieve in the world, whether it's to do with climate change, whether it's to do with clamping down on the big five tech firms, whether it's to do with having a proper security in relationship with our neighbours, or whether it's about trade and the economy, all of those things are served by Britain actually staying at the top table in the European club. And if you can't win that argument, well, then you're never going to persuade people that they want a referendum in order to have that argument. I can understand why the People's Vote campaign and some MPs in Parliament have been a bit hesitant about just going full throttle for the pro-European argument. What they've been doing is waiting for the Leave proposition, the Leave campaign, the Leavers to look so ridiculous, to discredit themselves so badly, that ultimately having a referendum and staying in the EU are the only things left on the table. But at some point, and I think that point is now, if it hasn't passed already, the argument has to shift to why Britain wants to stay in the EU. What is the purpose of the referendum? Once you've persuaded enough people, if you can make a positive, optimistic, open-hearted case for the country Britain wants to be as an EU member, well then the case for having a referendum to get you there makes itself.
That was Raphael Baer. You can read his column, which is out today, at theguardian.com. My thanks to Raphael and Oliver Holmes. Today's producers were India Rackerson and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design was by Eloise Stevens and Max Sanderson. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.